Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Vice Admiral Cecil D. Haney, Deputy Commander of the United States Strategic Command. He'll speak on the topic, United States Maritime Strategy in Asia and Beyond. Admiral Haney's remarks were given as part of the 2011-2012 Distinguished Lecture Series, sponsored by Creighton University's Asian World Center. The program was held as part of the 2011 United States Navy Week celebration. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday afternoon, September 9, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Mark Turner, Assistant Dean of the Creighton University College of Arts and Sciences.
Well, it's really a pleasure for me to introduce our distinguished speaker this afternoon, and Vice Admiral Cecil Haney. He's the Deputy Commander at STRATCOM. Before I do that, I'd like to recognize a special guest. Admiral Haney's wife is here and joined us. Bonnie, welcome. Admiral Haney is a native of Washington, D.C., and a 1978 graduate of the United States Naval Academy. He holds a Bachelor of Science degree in Ocean Engineering. He also holds a Master's degree in Engineering Acoustics and Systems Technology from the Naval Postgraduate School, and a Master's degree in National Security Strategy from the National Defense University. Admiral Haney has commanded and held key staff positions at almost every level in the United States Navy. He served in various capacities on the USS John C. Calhoun, the USS Frank Cable, the USS Hyman G. Rickover, the USS Asheville, and for Submarine Squadron 8. He also commanded USS Honolulu, Submarine Squadron 1, and Submarine Group 2. His shore duty tours included the administrative assistant for enlisted affairs at Naval Reactors and congressional appropriation liaison officer for the Office of the Secretary of Defense, deputy chief of staff of plans, policies, and requirements, U.S. Pacific Fleet, and director, Submarine Warfare Division, and the Naval Warfare Integration Group. Recently, President Barack Obama nominated Admiral Haney to become the next U.S. Pacific Fleet commander. Although his nomination is subject to Senate confirmation, Admiral Gary Ruffhead, the current Chief of Naval Operations, lauded Admiral Haney as the ideal officer to lead the Pacific Fleet, adding Vice Admiral Haney is a brilliant, proven leader, and he will excel as commander of U.S. Pacific Fleet. So on the personal recommendation of the Chief of Naval Operations, I'd like to ask you to help me welcome Admiral Haney, as I think he will provide us some unique insights to the Pacific Rim. Admiral Haney.
Good afternoon, and thank you for entertaining having me here, and particularly Dr. Zhang. Thank you for the time we've spent together, both coming over to our headquarters here at Offutt, U.S. Strategic Command, and having the opportunity to talk today with other deans here of this wonderful institution. It's sort of a treat for my bride and I, Bonnie, to be able to come here today. Just walking through the campus, I can tell some great things are going on here. And I thank you all for that. I'm going to adjust this a little bit because my aide's telling me I'm not coming across too loud. How's that? Okay. Well, it's really an honor for me to be here at the Asian World Center. And I didn't know this was here until we started this journey of discussing what was going to go on here with the Navy Week here in Omaha. And that this was a particular opportunity. So again, I really thank you all for this opportunity, one, to interact and hearing your thoughts, particularly over lunch, and hopefully what I have to share will be of interest to you. I would like to recognize the team here also, the number of deans we have here. I got to talk to Dean Luger here. Appreciate your time and Dean Turner as well. And I got to meet Lieutenant Colonel Mike Vick, who runs the ROTC unit here. But it's also for any faculty that's here and, of course, the students. Although my favorite subject to talk about is military operations and, of course, the United States Navy, I will say my other favorite topic to talk about is education, because I really think education is one of our most valuable resources we have in this country, and we cannot take it for granted. We have to continue to nourish it and cultivate it, because that's what's given the United States of America innovation and its ability to be where it is in the world today. I did want to stop, though, and pause to see if there are any veterans in the audience today, or military as well. If you could at least stand and be recognized, I'd appreciate that. And I thank you for your service. Today's event happens to coincide with this thing we call Navy Week here. And I'm especially pleased to be with you because I get to represent where I work today here at Offutt Air Force Base at the U.S. Strategic Command. You'll hear us call it STRATCOM. But that's the outfit I work for. And as I also represent our joint forces that are deployed worldwide and, of course, our United States Navy. So, you might ask, what is a sailor like me doing here in the middle of the country, here in the heartland of the United States of America? You might erroneously suspect that maybe my performance on ships was so dismal that I got sent here to the middle of the country. Well, I hope that's not the case. As the Deputy Commander of U.S. Strategic Command, I am one of about 586 sailors assigned to this joint combatant command. So you might then ask, what is Strategic Command doing that it would require so many sailors to be here in that population of thousands that work there in that particular facility, or our various components which are about the globe, but particularly here in the United States of America? I'll give you a glimpse of that. The President of the United States has assigned my boss, General Bob Kaler, the commander of U.S. Strategic Command, the responsibility to detect, deter, and prevent and defeat attacks against the United States, its territories, its possessions, and bases, and to employ appropriate force to defend the nation should deterrence fail. The command's specific mission responsibilities include planning, synchronizing, advocating, and employing capabilities to meet the nation's strategic deterrence, space operations, cyberspace operations, information operations, global strike, missile defense, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, and combating weapons of mass destruction objectives. We conduct these activities in close coordination with other combatant commands that are around the globe. So that's pretty interesting when you look at us going from the depths of the ocean all the way up into outer space. It's a joint command, so sailors are part of it because we join our fellow airmen, soldiers, Marines, and civilians, and it's an exciting place to work given the various responsibilities we have in our job jar. So that's why you also have sailors here in the heartland, and we have enjoyed living here for the time period I personally can state of really getting this heartland experience. So given that, I'd next like to frame the discussion that follows here in the following bends. I'll talk about the strategic environment we live in. Two, how our maritime strategy addresses this environment. And then I'll focus a little closer on the Asian Pacific maritime arena. And then as students, I'll at least seed you with a few things that I think maybe you ought to think about while you're here studying in this fine institution about that area. The environment. As you look at the national security landscape today, it continues to be marked by protracted conflict, constant change, enormous complexity. Today's operating environment is significantly different than those we've experienced in the past. The number and type of actors, state, non-state, terrorist, criminal, are rapidly changing, and the distinction between combatants and non-combatants is less clear. Friend and foe alike can span global distances in seconds through space and cyberspace, and technological advances allow adversaries to cross traditional geographic and military boundaries with ease. Adversaries seek advantages by using asymmetric means to find and exploit our vulnerabilities and to defeat our advanced capabilities in air, sea, space, and cyberspace. They also wield hybrid combinations of capabilities, strategies, and tactics and operate in the shadows to present us with ambiguous indications and situation. The entry costs have also been reduced with rapid technological evolution and the wide civil availability of formally advanced military capabilities. This is making available completely new weapons and enabling actors to access capabilities that would not have been available to them in the past without significant investment. Now, my boss, General Keillor, often reiterates how indeed surprise may be our deadliest foe, because it can make our plans ineffective, our training irrelevant, and therefore our organizations vulnerable. Hence, we need to prepare for surprise. So this is the strategic context, the environment that our joint forces, including our Navy, operates in today, and is used for us to evaluate alternate futures for tomorrow as we aim to use our military with our other instruments of national power to deter conflict, assure our nation and its allies, as well as to win if deterrence fails. In this age, where you look at how air travel is the norm, communications is nearly instantaneous by the internet, the iPhone, and modern technology, it's easy to forget that the United States of America is, in fact, a maritime nation. It has not been that long when visiting a grade school in another state that I asked the question to some students. I asked them, where does your iPhone or your iPad come from? Now, after a few answers, such as Best Buy or some other electronics store, it took us a while as we explored what country produces the iPhone or iPad, and then how does it get to the United States of America? Yes, we move information via cyberspace, but when it comes to global trade and commerce, most goods and products move primarily via the sea lanes. In a world that's 70% water, the overwhelming bulk of global trade, over 90%, moves by merchant ship, container ships laden with cargo, huge oil tankers that deliver energy, bulk carriers, and roll-on, roll-off vessels carrying commercial goods. According to the U.S. Department of Commerce, U.S. global trade last year amounted to about $3.1 trillion in total. U.S. Maritime Administration figures for 2010 indicate that more than $1.4 trillion of American foreign trade in goods was by sea. So, as a maritime nation bordered by two oceans, the United States relies heavily on the link to the sea, as it plays such a vital role in our commerce, our security, and our welfare. So you should not be surprised at the core of our concept of our maritime strategy, which we call a corporate strategy for 21st century sea power. It states the following. This strategy stresses an approach that integrates sea power with other elements of national power, as well as those of our friends and our allies. It describes how sea power will be applied around the world to protect our way of life as we join with other like-minded nations to protect and sustain the global interconnected system which we prosper. Our commitment to protecting the homeland and winning our nation's wars is matched by the corresponding commitment to preventing wars, end quote. This requires a maritime capability that requires the following: forward presence, power projection, deterrence, sea control, maritime security, humanitarian assistance, and, of course, disaster response. Yes, today, we are a global force that is forward. About 40% of our ships, submarines, and aircraft is deployed about the globe, providing that persistent presence. We do that with a force today that is about 280-plus ships, the smallest navy that this nation has had since 1916. I think our global responsibilities weren't quite the way they are today. There are, though, 328,000-some active sailors in the Navy and 65,000 reservists and about 160,000 Navy civilians on the team that allow us to do our performance in this maritime environment. On any given day, about 65,000 sailors are deployed. We continue to maintain, though, about 12 to 13,000 sailors in Afghanistan as part of the forces there. We have a construction battalions. We have explosive ordnance disposal teams. And, of course, we have our SEALs, our special forces that are there and continue to be in a high-end force that has great demands and work that they're called to do. So our ability to amass these maritime forces to project power and establish sea control is part of it, and that you got to see a lot on CNN through, obviously, the Libya campaign, Operation Iraqi Freedom, and Operation Enduring Freedom. But what about deterrence? With respect to deterrence, strategically, we rely on our nuclear triad, as was emphasized in the Nuclear Posture Review, and hopefully some of you will study that particular document as you go forward here. But in this nuclear triad, we have what we call our ballistic missile submarines that join our land-based Minuteman III missiles and our manned bombers to provide this unique capability, which we call strategic deterrent. The stealthy patrols carried out by submarines such as the USS Nebraska and other ballistic missile submarines ensure the survivability of our strategic deterrent and that our nation will always be able to respond to an adversary's threat. Our surface ships also have taken a role in deterrence in that they deploy the nation's missile defense capabilities, as our Aegis cruisers and destroyers are an integral part of the phase adaptive approach to missile defense to protect the United States and its allies from a limited ballistic missile threat. Similarly, if you will, the presence of multiple carriers and their associated strike group components in places like the Arabian Gulf provide another measure of deterrence and, when needed, can be called upon to project power. With respect to maritime security, as you look at illegal activity on the high seas, continues to threaten all trading nations, not just the United States. Piracy. I mean, I'm still amazed that in this day and age, we still have that word piracy as part of our vocabulary, but we do, and we're out there employing capability against it with our allies, friends, and partners every day. We're actually out there even working with the Chinese on that particular issue in parts of the globe. But piracy, human trafficking, illegal fishing, drug smuggling are crimes that are too prevalent today and that exploit ungoverned spaces and vulnerable people. Countering this is a vital mission of our maritime forces that is often done, as it is today, with combined maritime forces from other nations. When you think of our maritime global force for good, there's no better example than our nation's contributions to humanitarian relief efforts. Last year in Haiti, for example, 16 ships, 15,000 Navy personnel responded to providing rapid disaster relief following that devastating earthquake. After the March earthquake and tsunami in Japan, Navy vessels were quickly on hand to render sustained assistance during Operation Tomodachi, that is friend in Japan, in Japanese, and we did so by delivering food and water and helping to open harbors and airports. Besides responding in such emergency situations, our Navy schedules regular humanitarian missions to needy areas around the globe. The Pacific Partnership is one such proactive civic assistance program. This year, it brought the USS Cleveland together with the militaries of Japan, Australia, France, and New Zealand to provide medical, dental, and engineering outreach in a variety of different places, including Papua New Guinea and other places. And last year, the hospital ship USNS Mercy and USS Iwo Jima provided similar humanitarian assistance to our Pacific and Southern partners, working together with our NGOs, our non-governmental organizations. In summary, these aspects of our maritime security, force projection, forward presence, power projection, security cooperation, sea control, deterrence, maritime security, humanitarian assistance, and disaster relief can all be summed up and tied together with the imperative to foster and sustain international cooperation, because the issues we address and the security our Navy provides are not just in the interests of the United States. They serve the interests of our other nations that border the ocean and that depend on the sea for their economic livelihood. The Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Gary Ruffhead, recognized some time ago, though, that in what we do, we also needed to align ourselves and organize ourselves for success in another dimension, what we call information dominance. And you'd say, boy, that's a little strange for a seagoing service. But we reorganized and worked to synchronize and fully integrate information, intelligence, command and control, cyber, and network capabilities to use it also as a weapon. Because if we can't use the speed of information flow to our advantage, we will be behind the power curve. This is something we also work with our international partners. So I've given you that sort of broad brush of capability areas for the Navy in general, but I know this is the Asian World Center, so I need to refocus my efforts a bit here in the Pacific Rim. Having spent also a bit of time sailing about the Western Pacific, getting to also visit those countries in a variety of different other capacities, particularly over my last decade and a half in the United States Navy, I consider it a privilege to be able to talk a bit about this subject. Last year, you know, when you look at the Pacific Rim, about $980 billion of our trade and goods that moved to and from our ports was from or with Pacific Rim nations. Some 7,600 ocean-going vessels made nearly 63,000 calls at U.S. ports, and about one quarter of those were at U.S. Pacific Coast ports. The fact is, the United States is and will remain a Pacific power. And as Vice President Biden repeated during his recent Asian trip, quote, Asia and the United States is not separated by a Pacific Ocean. We're bound by it, end quote. Asia is home to three of four of the largest national economies in the world, measured by gross domestic product, with China, Japan, and India ranked behind the United States, but ahead of everyone else. As of last year, 10 of the world's 15 fast-growing economies were in Asia. Influences by the world's six largest military forces, Chinese, Russia, India, North Korea, South Korea, and the United States. Former Secretary of Defense Gates described the principles that we have fostered the economic growth and stability of the region. They include free and open commerce, a just international order that emphasizes rights and responsibilities of nations, and fidelity to the rule of law, open access by all to the domains of the sea, air, space, and now cyberspace, and the principle of resolving conflict without the use of force. Inside the Pacific Rim region, you will find half of the world's population, an area of evolving political and economic ties, increasing demand for resources and raw materials, rapid military modernization, particularly naval, competing national interests, regional and international disputes, and five mutual defense treaties with the United States. So I think you get the picture. The vast expanse also contains some significant challenges around the region. Look at Korea. Number of actions by North Korea recently have, of course, increased tensions. Sinking of the Republic of Korean vessel, the Cheonan, and the North's artillery bombardment of the Republic of Korea's territory, and the North Korea's efforts to acquire nuclear weapons and to develop, test, and deploy ballistic missiles that can also threaten Japan and the U.S. homeland. Reducing cross-strait tensions between China and Taiwan is a continuing area of interest. In particular, resolving differences peacefully and according to the wishes of the people on both sides of the straits is, of course, a priority. These territorial disputes among the countries bordering the southern China Sea, Vietnam, China, the Philippines, Indonesia, and Singapore are a potential source of friction, of course, for the future. In July, Secretary of State Clinton welcomed the announcement of the ASEAN, the Association for Southeastern Nations, and China were implementing guidelines to facilitate confidence-building measures in the South China Sea. This is an important first step in achieving a code of conduct and reflects the progress that can be made through dialogue and multilateral diplomacy. The United States opposes the threat or use of force by any claimant in the South China Sea to advance its claims or interfere with legitimate economic activity, and we support collaborative diplomatic processes by all claimants to resolve the various disputes in the region. As a Pacific power, the United States has interest in freedom of navigation, open access to Asian maritime domain, the maintenance of peace and stability, and respect for the international law in the South China Sea. And the United States remains committed to maintaining a robust forward presence in East Asia to protect our interests and maintain security. I've already mentioned that China has accounted for a great deal of the dramatic economic growth in the region. Likewise, China figures to play a significant role regarding stability in the region. So let me share a few thoughts with you about China as a trading partner, as a competitor, and as a potential actor to contribute to the stability in the region. The United States, of course, welcomes the emergence of a China that is peaceful and prosperous and that actively participates in and contributes to international institutions. As our relationships with China continues to expand, and as China becomes more closely aligned with international norms, more closely bound to international institutions, we look to China to bear greater responsibility to strengthen, support, and responsibly reform the global system that has provided peace, stability, and prosperity to America, China, and the region. Many of China's stated economic interests dovetail with our goals, that is, to expand economic opportunity and growth in the region by lowering trade investment barriers, increasing market transparency, and promoting balanced, inclusive, and sustainable patterns of economic growth. The United States is China's biggest trade partner, and China is America's second largest trade partner. Total bilateral trade exceeds $400 billion per year, making this trade relationship one of the most important in the world. Our two economies are not just partners, but also competitors. We welcome that competition, which can spur growth and improve economic health. As President Obama has said, the key for us to make sure that competition is friendly, that it's a competition for consumers, customers, and markets, and that it's within the bounds of well-defined international rules of the road that both China and the United States are party to. However, a major concern is that China's stated interest in a peaceful and stable environment that will support the country's developmental goals is difficult to reconcile with new military capabilities that appear designed to challenge United States' freedom of action in the region or to enforce China's influence over its neighbors and resolve disputes in its favors, including with our regional allies and partners. The Pentagon recently released a report to Congress on China's military and security developments, and it underscores concerns that China's arms buildup should be closely monitored in view of China's lack of transparency and upward trend in its military capabilities. And I'm sure all of you have read that report because I'm sure it's on the best readers list here at Creighton. This Pentagon report also noted that numerous intrusions into the computer systems around the world in 2010 appear to have originated from China, and that developing capabilities for cyber warfare is consistent with authoritative Chinese military writing. In Chinese military doctrine, information warfare is seen as integral to achieving information security and an effective means for countering a stronger foe. While China has made modest but incremental improvements in transparency in its military and security affairs, there still remains uncertainty about how China will use its growing capabilities. We believe that reconciling China's stated defense-oriented intentions with its increasing offensive military capabilities can only occur through continuous, frank conversations and mutual actions with a strong and mature military-to-military relationship. In the meantime, it is all the more important that the United States continue to maintain the readiness of our forces, to continually reinforce our commitment to our allies and partners in the region, and meet each challenge by the Chinese in a professional manner that is consistent with international law. My recommendation, again, is that you students carefully read and study this report. So finally, I would like to suggest that your studies here include a few things. One, are we doing enough with our instruments of national power to ensure the lines of communication, freedoms of navigation, continue in the Western Pacific? Also, what alternate futures may occur, and how do we best prepare ourselves for those futures, especially as it relates to maintaining peace and prosperity in the Pacific Rim? Number three, how do we ensure the rise of military capability in the Western Pacific adds to a peaceful environment to add to stability in the region? And the list goes on to include work to prevent the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, illicit activities in these vital sea lanes and surrounding maritime regions. And finally, how do we ensure America does not forget it is a maritime nation dependent on the free flow of goods through the maritime domain? So from Australia all the way up to Russia, the Western Pacific is a vital area of critical sea lines of communication. You should be proud to know that your Navy sailors remain on watch throughout the world and are present with a critical eye with other partner nations in this critical region. It is out there working diligently with other friend, partner, and allied nations together with mutual respect for each other on the high seas. I've mentioned this range of U.S. military strategy in providing stability and security for our nation, our allies and partners. But let me sum it up in another way, again using a quote from the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Gary Ruffhead. He said, quote, "We do more than just respond. We prevent. It's just as important to prevent wars as it is to win wars. That is done through our worldwide presence, our well-trained sailors, and our very capable ships, airplanes, and submarines," end quote. From prevention and deterrence to security and humanitarian assistance, that's our Navy's contribution as a global force for good. We are grateful for the support of Nebraskans and all Americans for keeping that force strong, effective, and respected about the world. And it's great that we'll see more of Navy here in the heartland with Navy Week here. And I shouldn't be surprised, because you have four ships that are in fact named after the heartland area. First, there was the USS Omaha, a screw-driven sloop that was commissioned in 1872, served in both the Atlantic and the Asiatic stations. And while on the Asiatic station in February of 1890, Omaha sent ashore a detachment of officers and crews from that vessel to fight an extensive fire in the Japanese town of Hokkaido, an early forerunner of this humanitarian assistance and disaster relief efforts that the Navy continues to this day. You have a second USS Omaha that was a light cruiser back in the 1920s, served and fought throughout World War II in the Atlantic and in the Mediterranean. And it, too, has a great story associated with it. Third Omaha, USS Omaha, was a nuclear-powered submarine. It was a Los Angeles class that served from 1978 to 1995. Same class that I spent a lot of my adult life on, but different ship. And in the true tradition of our connection to the heartland, today the USS Nebraska is currently serving, as I mentioned earlier, as a ballistic missile submarine that forms part of our nuclear triad. And the crew of that submarine is actually boots on the ground here in the area and will be throughout the next week here as well. So it's good for them to get some liberty here in the heartland accordingly. So the Navy connection with Omaha, Nebraska, and the heartland runs very deep and very close. If you get the chance during Navy Week to participate in endeavors such as the Guardian of Freedom Air Show in Lincoln, you ought to take the chance to do so, and there you can see the Blue Angels, our precision aerobatic flight team, do their performance with F-18s. And if you see any of our sailors out in town, I would only please ask that you would stop and thank them for their service, just as I hope you're thanking fellow airmen, soldiers, and Marines for theirs. Thank you for your attention, and I'll be now glad to answer any of your questions. Thank you.
The first question from the audience was, what effect the presence of new war-class aircraft carriers would have on our relationships with the countries in Asia?
Well, with each era of naval vessel that we commission, and particularly the technology we put on them is always tremendous. The impact, though, is really felt in the many years to come to have a vessel that's capable to last a long time. These carriers we have kept in some cases for almost 50 years. And having recently gone within the year on USS Enterprise, a carrier that was off the East Coast, it was the first time, for example, that I got to fly on board, get a trap, and also see their flight operations and also take off from it. So it was a neat experience for a submariner. But the real key there you have a tremendous capability that has a number, over 30-some aircraft on board. And it's not just the aircraft, it's the capability and the recycle rate that they're able to take that carrier, steam it in wherever it needs to be in whatever part of the globe, and take off and land that force and replenish it and keep it out there sustained and operating for months on end. And it's that piece that they were out there practicing that I got to see, and you can just get it that in itself is a true statement of America commitment. So as we have today, for example, USS George Washington, it's out there in the Western Pacific, we clearly, as time marches on, will want to replace that capability with something that helps with advanced technology to allow us to be able to win the fight for many, many years to come. So there are new technologies. For example, I mentioned being catapulted off. Well, one of the new technologies is the mechanism by which we do that on that carrier. Now we use steam, and there's a different mode of capability there involving electromagnetic forces, for example, to do the same thing. So that's part of the business. But everything we do as we design it new is so that we can do that business of getting them off the carrier faster so they can go off and do their business in an efficient and effective manner. Thank you for that question.
The next question was what the Admiral sees as the primary challenge at STRATCOM during his current tour of duty and what he sees as the challenges of his next assignment as commander of the United States Pacific Fleet.
Very good. Excellent question. You remember my discussion over surprise, dealing with surprise. Here Sunday, we will celebrate the 10th anniversary of 9/11. And most of us my age and a little bit younger really remembers what you were doing that particular day. For me, of course, I was a bit surprised to see it on the TV set while stationed in the Pentagon. And knowing what occurred during that day, that really wasn't what America, wasn't what we all woke up as a military expecting to happen. So I use that as just an analogy that the thing that keeps me up at night, whether I work at Strategic Command or whether I'm so blessed to be confirmed by the Senate to have that opportunity in the Pacific Fleet, is that whole business of will we be forward-thinking? Will we plan enough ahead of time? Will we be working on the right thing so that we're ready to deal with surprise and that we will be able to use surprise to our favor if deterrence fails and we have to deal with it? That I look at as the biggest piece. And you go back through the history and having had about 7 blessed years on the island of Hawaii, not all together, but in multiple tours, every time I would see that memorial of the Arizona going in and out of port or walking along Ford Island, again, it would remind me again of this business that we have to be forward-thinking, forward-leaning, not resting on our laurels, so that we are able to deal with surprise as it comes our way in those types of fashion. So I would say that's probably one. But I would also add with it, as we roll up our sleeves here dealing with the economic condition of the country right now and through the associated debates we must have in a democratic fashion, that we are able to make the right choices and do the right thing, because this is hard stuff. The world is a very complex place. Whether from my experience of walking around Indonesia, walking around Japan, steaming around, or actually getting all through a variety of different places in Africa. Didn't matter which part of the globe. Each part has its own intricacies, its own unique history, its own culture, and how we intermix that in a world of people in a way that keeps us all on the right side of the spectrum of peace is incredibly complex. So as we go through that debate, that we make sure we do the right things so that we have the right capability to, number one, avoid war where we can, deter it, but if deterrence fails, that we are able to respond as we must.
Admiral Haney was asked how he sees the shrinkage of the nuclear submarine force in response to the overall reduction of warheads, and even to the point where we go back to a minimum deterrent position with submarines, and use electronics and other more advanced types of weaponry and modernization to keep the deterrence in place, but with more advanced materials rather than the more traditional and more terrifying understanding of Trident submarines.
Good question. Now, I could probably spend 3 hours on that one, but I won't. I'll try to condense it. You sort of framed it in terms of, am I worried about number of submarines and all that? Now, working at U.S. Strategic Command, as I went through those mission areas that we had up there on the slide, and nuclear strategic deterrence being one of those, the one piece is very important in our daily work is the right balance of all that stuff. Cyber, for example, is one of those. When you start looking at nuclear weapons, I am one that I personally don't want to have one more than I need to have. But I am also mindful, though, of how many other nations have modernization programs in nuclear weapons. So we, the United States of America, as we carry out those orders, that guidance in the Nuclear Posture Review, was signed by our leadership. If you read that carefully, it says, quite frankly, our number one priority is to prevent weapons of mass destruction to be used in the wrong way. And as part of that, you know, we maintain our arsenal of nuclear weapons for deterrence, for assurance of our allies. And then, of course, if deterrence fails. So then it becomes, how much do you need? Now, if I had in here a graph of the number of nuclear weapons we had over the history of nuclear weapons and where we are now, I think you would be pleased to see the slope of that curve and how we as a world are a lot lower in those numbers. And the scrutiny that we must do and have over the nuclear START treaties and associated follow-ons, our negotiations with Russia, our work with other countries that have nuclear weapons and what have you, and the security of those nuclear weapons is a multidimensional sport. So I can't just simplistically take it to one SSBN or five of them or whatever number out there at sea. When I first started my career, we had 55 for Freedom associated with that number of SSBNs. Today, we have 14 ballistic missile submarines that are out there doing the business. So again, this whole business deserves to be debated, et cetera, so that we only have that military might that we're required to have in the balance of power of things. But we have to be mindful that others have these modernization programs. Others have ramps up associated with their capability, and even as we look at carrying out that direction in nuclear posture review in terms of reducing the utilization of nuclear weapons for the future, we have to do that mindful of other things. So I'm just as much of a cheerleader on nuclear weapons as I am on cyber capability, on terms of space capability, et cetera, because that we must.
As a final question, the Admiral was asked if he knows who his counterparts are in China and in India, and if so, does he have, on a regular basis, any direct contact with them?
Since I've been at U.S. Strategic Command, I have not met my counterpart in China. But I'll say, as you look at our relationship as a country with China, you have to put it in that context and where we have gone over the history book of different events that have occurred. The good news, quite frankly, now is not about me and my contact with my counterpart. The good news is about the recent visit in July of the chairman of the Joint Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, that went over there and spent some quality time with the leadership, followed, of course, by what you read more recently with that going on with the Vice President of the United States here. Those types of engagements have to occur, and as those things occur, and including the work of Secretary of State Clinton, I believe it was May, during some of the various conferences she worked with China. So there's been a continual heartbeat and trend of our dialogue and our work together from that level that hopefully as we go further and further along, that will materialize into more military-to-military relationships. The business, for example, as I alluded to, of us doing anti-piracy type operations together. That was not going on back in my last tour of duty at U.S. Pacific Fleet, but I'm proud to say we're doing more of that now. So I don't think you would want every admiral in the United States Navy or every general in the military picking up the phone every day talking, quite frankly, with where our relationship is right now. It is a mature relationship that needs more maturity, and it will continue to hopefully blossom as we go along. That's what these visits were about. That's what President Obama's been talking about, and that's what we're here as a military to support.
You've been listening to a lecture from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Vice Admiral Cecil D. Haney, Deputy Commander of the United States Strategic Command. He spoke on the topic, United States Maritime Strategy in Asia and Beyond. Admiral Haney's remarks were given as part of the 2011-2012 Distinguished Lecture Series, sponsored by Creighton University's Asian World Center. The program was held as part of the 2011 United States Navy Week celebration. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday afternoon, September 9th, 2011, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, and Dr. Maorong Jiang, Director of the Asian World Center, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.